Good evening. So I want to confess, I've been obsessing on something. I love the acronym RAIN. I use it a lot. I'm working on stillness, understanding, nirvana, sun. What do you think? Does that work? Come up with something for us. We need a sun acronym here. I'm all for radical acceptance, too, but, you know. So I wanted to start by sharing a story I heard this year, a few months ago, and really liked. And this is about the magician Harry Houdini, who traveled around Europe visiting small towns, and he'd challenge local jailers to, he'd have them put him in a straitjacket and then put him in a cell and lock him in, and he'd throw off the straitjacket and break out of the cell, and voila, and everybody would be all impressed. He'd delight crowds with his quick escapes. But then he, at some point, I think it was in Ireland, it was an Irish village, he ran into trouble, and he was in front of a crowd of townspeople and news reporters, and he easily broke free from the straitjacket, but no matter how much he worked on the lock, he couldn't get himself out of the cell. So after everyone left, he admitted defeat, and he asked the jailer, is this some newfangled, sophisticated lock I've never seen or whatever? And the jailer said, oh no, it's actually a very ordinary one. I just never bothered locking it. He had been locking himself in with all his fiddling. And you get the Dharma in this one, right? That we can see it here, how much of our, we perceive something's wrong. We're very conditioned in a very deep way to perceive something's wrong. And we're spending a lot of energy trying to get out of solve a problem, get out of a stuck situation. And the very activity of trying to maneuver our way out actually consolidates the trance. And so we're going to be exploring this a bit more. And one of my favorite stories of retreats is of one woman who did all the ups and downs of, fear and sleepiness and obsessing and silence and now I'm failing and what, just, and then she finally got to the end of the retreat and she said, I figured it out, that the joy is in getting real. That in the moments of just this is the experience, that kind of clarity of, oh, it's like this, when there's not a trying to make it different, there's a kind of freedom that's possible. And I've seen it in the interviews here so many times, that the experiences of freedom are the experiences of, in some way, a real awakening. They're not because it's a particularly pleasant state or really good meal or great shower. It's not like that. It's when life has been happening and finally there's a stopping of the resisting and there's just the being real. It's being with. And in that, there's a kind of homecoming or a trust in, oh, the presence is what frees us. And that's always with us, or available. The simplest description of the spiritual path for me, in some way, comes down to that there's this awakening going on from some limiting story of a self, that I am a separate self. And a discovery or a realization of a vastness, of a presence, of a love that's really our home. And that's just happening. There's not a self making it happen. It's just happening. And that they're the core delusion that we live in. I mean, if I had to say the script, if we had to describe the script of our trance that we're in, is I'm a separate self. The world's out there. Life's happening to me. Something's wrong about it. Something's missing. And I'm kind of occupied with trying to make things work out. It's a kind of script that we spend a lot of time in. So it's like Houdini. There's an assumption of something's wrong. And I really invite you to check that out. in how many moments there's some level of sensing something's happening to a self and that the self is an agent trying to make things okay. I remember when answering machines first came out, it was a long time ago, I had a friend who had a machine, and when you called and he wasn't there, he'd pick it up, and what you'd hear is a voice saying, "What I want to know is, who are you? And what do you want?" You know? Deep inquiry, you know. And what's interesting is that they're one and the same. That who we are, the deepest level of who we are, is what we want. What we're longing for is who we are. There's a story I heard about Sri Narsargadatta, who's a wonderful Indian teacher. This is when he was asked about how he became enlightened. And his response was, "My guru told me that I am the supreme source of all. I pondered that for several years until I knew that it was true, until I became it." Then he added, "I was lucky because I trusted what I was told." So that's what I'd like to say to you tonight, is that you are the supreme source of it all. And ask, how many of you trust me? Come on. So I can end the talk now, right? This is it. So that's the deal. Is there something we do know? You know, there is some idea that we're seeking something and that it's down the road and it's out there. And, you know, sometimes I like to just say, and I'll do it right now with you, let's just do an experiment. And for the next, maybe, let's say 20 seconds, okay, just stop being aware. Okay, just stop being aware. Okay, so raise your hand if you succeeded. You were able to stop? Let's talk afterwards, I'd be curious. I always love this. There was some cartoon of a bunch of bugs in a carpet of fur wondering if there really is a dog, you know? So awareness, what we long for, is here. It's not like we have to reach anywhere to find it. And the path is this awakening from this story is really realizing what's here, realizing what we are. And we go into what I sometimes think of as, you know, just call virtual reality, which is we live in these ideas and the ideas cause us pain. So I just want to explore this more tonight, really, the trance that we live in and how this waking up and realizing happens. And just to honor that this is a pretty optimal setting for catching on to, yes, there's a trance, because how many of us have had now many, many rounds of being lost in some story, some thought, some something, waking up and, the birds. And just knowing the difference between listening to our thoughts and the birds. And then even to, in the sense, listen even more deeply and sense the presence that's there. We begin to catch it. And we also begin to catch how many moments we're gone planning and worrying and blaming and judging. And there's most of the time it's about what's going on here, but we're also very aware and very much projecting our ideas on who's here. It's a fascinating thing. This is how we project the world out there. Share with you, so I think, one of the best single ads I've ever read. Single black female seeks male companionship, ethnicity unimportant. I'm a very good-looking girl who loves to play. I love long walks in the woods, riding in your pickup truck, hunting, camping and fishing trips, cozy winter nights by the fire, Candlelight dinners will have me eating out of your hand. Rub me the right way and watch me respond. I'll be at the front door when you get home from work wearing only what nature gave me. Kiss me and I'm yours. Call, and there's a number here, and it says, ask for Daisy. Over 15,000 men found themselves talking to the Atlanta Humane Society about an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever. So we have these ideas. But really, our ideas about the world are always not what it is. So, so as a huge amount of our thinking is basically there's this story going on and the protagonist is moi. That's the big deal. In fact, you'll be in any crowd of people, all of us here, and there's still a story and each one of us has the protagonist of me. And what is going to happen and what I need and what I'm afraid of and what needs to be different. So there's this guy at a bar talking to the bartender and he's saying, I'm nothing and yet I'm all I can think about, you know. So when we're in this thinking trance, our identity takes the shape of the story we're telling ourselves, and because a lot of the fear in our body keeps generating thoughts, we're living in a kind of fearful reality that keeps us kind of divided. And usually the content of the thoughts that are fear-based are, I'm falling short, and if not now, I will fall short, and that there's going to be too much to handle. Something around the corner will be too much. And our body, meanwhile, is kind of tensing against what's around the corner. Or that it'll never be different, which then feeds the biochemistry of depression. Or that so-and-so is causing it, which feeds the biochemistry of anger. And so our body gets this biochemical, you know, kind of cocktail mix, and then it generates these thoughts, which then we believe, and it keeps the body cooking. So we get caught in this loop. And it basically comes down to something's wrong with me, something's wrong with you, something's wrong with life. It can be in spiritual communities as much as anywhere else that there's a sense of the other is other and wrong. And some of you might remember this story about a Taoist master. I like it so much I'll share it. He's sitting naked in his mountain cabin meditating. And a group of Confucianists entered the door of his hut, having hiked up the mountain, intending to lecture him on the rules of proper conduct. When they saw the sage sitting naked before them, they were shocked and asked, "What are you doing sitting in your hut without any pants on?" The sage replied, "This entire universe is my hut. This little hut is my pants. What are you fellows doing inside my pants?" You know. So it's an us and them world when we're in thoughts. And the most fundamental way that it causes suffering is that our virtual reality covers over the what's actually happening right here. So we are in this familiar cocoon of worries and plans. And this, it's, I think John O'Donohue said it. He said, this wild, mysterious existence gets reduced to cookie-cutter days and patterns that are static. Pema Chodron puts it this way. She says, being preoccupied and being preoccupied with our self-image is like being deaf and blind. It's like standing in the middle of a vast field of wildflowers with a black hood over our heads. It's like coming upon a tree of singing birds while wearing earplugs. So again, we each here have our moments and our stretches of the freedom of here-ness, that our senses are awake and there's awareness of the nature around us and the silence and moving and living and being. And the story has fallen away some. So it's just what's happening. And then, as we know, it's kind of like the gremlins. We're back. It's like it all reconfigures. And Ajahn Shanti describes it as the, you know, those birthday candles that no matter how much you blow them out, they just go, poof, they come back again. It's like that. And a couple of people told me today the experiences of really, of the story falling away. And of really cherishing that light and stillness and vastness. And of how painful it is to feel the dukkha of the reconfiguring, and it happens so easily. Because our conditioning, our deep, deep conditioning, is to perceive separation and to live in this kind of the primal mood of the separate self, which is fear, and to have our thoughts and feelings circle around that. And I've described some different times how out of that basic perception of being separate, each of us tries to navigate or control what's happening. And you can see it in your meditations and you can see it in daily life, that we're trying to maneuver our way so that bad things don't happen and more good things happen. And we get identified with that maneuvering. There's a sense of, I am the agent that's trying to make it okay. I'm the one that has to resist. And so this is our evolutionary predicament, that all incarnated creatures have a perception of the selves in here and a world's out there. And it's not the end of the evolutionary story. Because the very nature of what we are is this awareness that can recognize that trance. That our very nature is this awake awareness that can see that there's been a story, that can be aware of that story, and in that moment rediscover its own luminosity. Right in this moment. You can even say, have I been dreaming? And detect that there's been this whole film going on that's kept us one step removed from the immediacy and vividness of presence. So the path that we'll explore a little more as we go this evening, we'll do a couple of reflections. The alchemy of waking up, I think of it as two parts, and one is intention, which is really the voice of awareness calling us home. You know, when we reflect on intention, it's not like we're having to create something, like we're kind of grabbing it out of the air. Okay, what matters? It's like we're listening into some deep yearning that's really the calling of heart and awareness. It's almost like if we really listen and we remember it, we are home. It's the voice of awareness. So there's intention. It's that yearning when there's some sense of confusion and delusion, a yearning to come home. And then there's the attention itself, this relaxed attentiveness that it seems like we're training, but it's actually the activity of awareness. So one of the best descriptions that I've heard of how this practice is a non-practice in a way, is Swami Satchidananda. He was approached by someone who wanted to know if they had to do had to be a Hindu to do yoga. And he says, no, I am not a Hindu. I am an undo, you know. I just think that's so good because we're not doing something. It's like I think the first night here I said the doing is the clenching of the fist. There's a kind of a delusion of a self-clenching. But the practice is when there's an awareness of that, there's a natural, in the field of awareness, there's a natural loosening of the grip. There's an undoing, a disidentifying. So how that happens here is that our intentionality allows us to recognize that when we're living in thoughts, when we're lost in thoughts, we've forgotten who we are. We're one step removed. So there's this innate intelligence that gets it. That when we're believing our thoughts, we're not able to be here. And we're not able to recognize the presence that's here. So the practice is part of the intentionality of our path is to wake up out of the identification with thoughts, not to vanquish thoughts, And I say that because I've seen in so many spiritual traditions this kind of at war with one's mind and conquering one's mind, and the whole metaphor that has to do with the kind of warrior that's going to slay the thoughts and break free and get to another realm. And it's not that. I mean, thoughts are another emanation of awareness. It's just not to be lost. Probably the best description of when I describe this trance we're in is of ocean and waves, and that there's an oceanness, and that when incarnation happens, waves arise, there's some conditioning to have awareness think it's the wave and forget its oceanness. And that just happens. There's a forgetting. And yet, because the ocean's aware, it again perceives itself as the very nature of the wave. So with thoughts, we get lost in the wave of thought, and yet there's an awakeness that notices, oh, lost. That's the ocean awareness noticing. And then there's a coming back to a more of a whole presence. So that's one step. And without doing some quieting, it's very, very difficult to deepen our intention. And it's very difficult to deepen our sense of, oh, what's really here? So that's what we've done. So far we've been a few days and there's some quieting going on. It's for everybody. I can sense it. And then what happens as we quiet is all the tangles that we've been so busy that we've managed to sidestep experiencing begin to make themselves, make us aware of them. That's just what happens. And it's so people wonder, they come here and they wonder, but I can say honestly, I've never done a week-long retreat without weeping deeply thus far. There's always some mourning or grieving or something that just, and it feels good, right? Real, feels real. It's just part of the tangles untangling. So then the inquiry is how do we, how do we show up for that, for these tangles that so many of us are experiencing? And the RAIN acronym is real useful because, it basically says, well, just recognize and allow that, okay, there's some constellation of fear, anger, hurt, or obsessing. Just recognize and allow it. And then let's begin to deepen our presence with it. And in that presence, there's a disidentifying. The main elements in the tangle are usually what we're believing, what we're subscribing to that we might not notice, and the feelings in the body that are going on. And if we can recognize the more core level belief, like, I have to do something to fix this, or it's not fair, one person shared with me that, just really just get, oh, so there's some belief it's not fair, or some belief that I've been failing all along. In the moment of really recognizing the belief, there's less identification with it. But it doesn't stop there, because we have to bring a full and courageous presence to where the feelings are living in our body. And it's not until we've been unconditionally present with the rawness that presence allows us to loosen the identification. So again, the whole self project, the whole sense of self depends on controlling. As long as there's resisting and navigating and maneuvering and thinking our way and figuring, there's going to be a sense of self. When we stop controlling, what dissolves? That sense of self. It hooks us on controlling because it's a little scary to sense that center, that cherished center that we think we are, isn't going to be there. So there's a hook. And yet, our freedom is full allowing presence. There's a Catholic priest who is no longer alive, Anthony DeMello, and he described enlightenment this way. He said, it's absolute cooperation with the inevitable. Do you like that one? Absolute cooperation with the inevitable. And what's interesting is our ego or our spacesuit self or whatever you want to call it is totally organized resistance. It's just a mess of strategies and organized resistance. So what you got here is freedom is completely letting go of resistance, undoing. So here's the challenge that I want to put out, which is, how do we really say yes? How do we do this allowing when our entire nervous system and mind is saying no? In other words, when everything in us is organized around, I don't like this, I don't want this, I want to make it go away, how does that turn into absolute cooperation with the inevitable? It's like Henry David Thoreau says, if a dog runs at you, whistle for it. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not my spontaneous inclination. You know, it's like, it's not right away. There's some lag time, or Rumi's guest house, invite them in, you know. So our predicament, and many of you have brought it up at different times, is that we have these meditation instructions that say recognize and allow. And what we find is that we say, okay, we'll allow, but it's a little bit of lip service because there's usually bargaining mind that's saying, I'm only allowing because I think it's going to go away. How many of you have noticed that in here? Because there's been, yeah, I thought so, okay. So the question that comes to me a lot is, where is the real integrity, this unconditional acceptance, when that bargaining mind just jumps in all the time? It just keeps on wanting the pain to go away. I'm not really accepting it. So it seems that one of the most valuable things for me has been to recognize that it doesn't have to be pure. You can have the intention to allow. And that intention is very pure because it comes from this intelligence that recognizes the freedom when we're really allowing. And still have all that conditioning to resist, play out. The deal is, how much can you be aware of that? And I want to share a story, my own story of where I kind of hit a wall, because this, it really had this basic theme I'm talking about of not really being able to allow something. And for decades and decades, I've known about the trance of unworthiness. And I wrote Radical Acceptance a lot because I saw the suffering in that. But it was somewhere in the middle of writing Radical Acceptance that I became more aware in my personal life of how the more kind of chronic, niggling little judgments, the daily judgments, not the I'm a total dismal failure or you're a complete, you know, horror. It wasn't that level. It was more the little kind of slightly derogatory thoughts, the tiny little put-downs that were pretty chronic. How much suffering was in them. And so I began this sadhana, this spiritual practice, where I really had my eye out for any bit of blame or put down towards others. You know, I was already monitoring for myself, and I knew that was big and it was still there. And I was really aware for others. And what really the suffering was is I could just sense how it was lonely. I was separating. I was creating separation with my judgment. And even more visceral, I started sensing when I was judging how my body felt bad. Just felt bad. I felt tight. And then in a deep way, I really, really didn't like myself. It's like the judgments made me not like myself. I was a judgy person. And so I kept trying to stop. And I had all these strategies of any time I'm judging anyone, I'm going to pause and I'm going to do this. And it would work in the moment. I would pause and I'd feel under the judgment maybe some fear or whatever. And I'd be with the fear and I'd remember that, oh, I'm not the fear and I'm not the judge. You know, it would all work. Except for then it would come right back again and I would hate it and I'd hate myself for it. It was like it didn't matter how much I worked, I couldn't get rid of the judging. And kind of culminated one Christmas. This was before my dad died. And I was at my family home in New Jersey and everybody was there and all the extended was there. And I thought I was really pissed off at a couple of people, and then I realized I was just uniformly down on everybody. I had some, I had a gripe about everybody there, something they were doing wrong, in some way they were being neurotic, or it's just hard to tolerate, or just doing their routines. Of course, this was family of origin stuff, so I have to give it a little bit of, you know, after 48 hours, most of us crumble. But then at one point it became very poignant because my dad had already had a heart attack and, you know, who knows how long people have. And my sister was moving to the West Coast and my son, Narayan, was, you know, maybe entering junior high and separating. And so I remember one night I went out and it was a rainy night. Truth. And I was going to work on the judgment and it wouldn't go away. It was like I would work on it, but then in some way I'd get tripped off by another thought of another person. And I hit this wall where I just realized I can't do this. I cannot transcend judging. I can't make it go away. And there was this combination of it's totally painful and I can't control it. And in that moment of really this kind of pure ouch, and this pure recognition of this self cannot will and transcend judgment, there was kind of a collapsing in a really freeing way. It was a kind of a surrendering, like, this is how it is. It's just like this. It's like there was no longer some pushing to make it different. Instead, there was just this enormous compassion, like, ouch, this hurts, and this conditioning is part of this body-mind. And in the space of kind of surrendering, this collapsing of this willfulness, because I was trying to will myself, in that space, there was just a really spacious kind of tenderness. And if I had to say, through the eyes of that tender space, that wasn't me that was judging, and it wasn't me that was bad, and it wasn't them that was bad. There was just awareness and this conditioning playing out. It was an undoing, but the undoing didn't come because I managed to maneuver my way out of judgment. It's because I gave up, or there was a giving. I can't even say I gave up. Giving up happened because awareness saw that the self couldn't do it. Is this making sense? I'm speaking of it because there's something, it's very deep how much surrendering goes. And sometimes the saying yes is that we're saying yes to the reality that the self can't say yes, the self can't accept. Accepting and yes happens, it's awareness that is allowing. And all that can happen is awareness can see how it is. And in that seeing, there's more beingness. We reside more in that awareness. So the update, so to speak, is that judgments still happen. It just, as I've said here, I've used the expression lag time. It's quicker that it's not so personal. And in the not adding, I'm so bad for this and I've got to make this go away, in that space, there's actually a tenderness and a forgiving that goes on. And not believing the judgments, just not believing them, which is where the freedom is. There's also something that happens, whether it's judgment or anything else that I want different, is that as soon as there's a recognition of it's like this, there's a possibility of calling on love, calling on compassion. And that's not a doing. It's almost like a remembering of what's there. And when it's really, really difficult to call on loving presence, some of what we did today in our guided meditation actually softens the heart. It softens that sense of a willful self, and it creates more of this, where there's a kind of a receptivity. In other words, it undoes that self as agent and it reconnects with that kind of space that's open, that can receive. So our practice here, over and over again, really is to start right where we are. And sometimes it's very, very busy, and we do some skillful means of quieting the mind. We move our bodies in certain ways. We focus our attention. We try to wake up out of thoughts and come back. And when there's a tangle, the intention is how much can we just plain be aware of it and let it be, including how much we don't want to let it be, which is kind of the point of my story there. The gift, and this is where I wanted to go, because I started by saying that, you know, when we stop putting that key in the hole and trying so hard to get out of something, when we stop all that activity, when there's some stillness, we discover the freedom that's already here. That awareness is always and already here. And there is a shift of a sense of who we are from the self that's trying to make things different to inhabiting that stillness, that silence, that presence. Sri Nisargadatta, who I mentioned earlier, describes this awakening from this story of a small self in this way. He says, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. Now, when I reflect on that or when I share it, I always sense there's something that the depth of us really understands. And yet, if we try to think about it, it can get all confusing. There's something about it, though, that really resonates. And I'd like to say a few words, even though it's a bit futile, but try. But the spirit is good, that we just kind of pay attention to what does that mean, that love says I'm everything, and the wisdom says I'm nothing or no thing. So one thing that we discover as we become very present, as the thoughts calm down and quiet down, is that there's not so much of a dividedness. Thoughts create the division. The very nature of thoughts is they pose a reality that's static, and that there's in that reality a subjective self and an object world. When we're quiet, when there's really a quieting of those thoughts, that whole self-object world starts dissolving. So I'd like to invite you to do, if you'd like to close your eyes, if that helps to deepen attention, do so. Let's reflect for a few moments. So what does it mean to say that love tells me I'm everything? And the invitation is to start right here in this moment, and that simple inquiry of what's happening right here. And what happens if there's just a total letting be? So the senses are awake. And there's awareness of the sounds. An awareness of the field of sensation with the intention of not controlling, just letting the life live through. But awareness doesn't oppose or resist anything. So this world of sound, sensation, feelings, it's just free to play out. And you can notice that it's all occurring in the field of awareness. Sense how deeply it's possible, this letting be. Just being the awareness, the silence that's listening. This vast stillness that knows sensation and aliveness. Sense how anything you experience, any thought of any person, any feelings that come up, belong to this awareness. Occur in this awareness and are known by awareness. And you might bring to mind a person where there's a lot of love for you. And sense what lets the love flow. What is it about the person? About the way they love you? About what they are? So that you let the experience of loving be very visceral. Feel your heart. How that love echoes through your being. So that even if you let go of the image of the person, totally let go of the image of the person, that love is absolutely vast and here and timeless. That being or any being that arises in awareness is a part of your being, and the love that's expressed through awareness is timeless and here. Love knows I'm everything. Taking a few deep breaths and coming back. I want to share an experience Thich Nhat Hanh wrote about that I think expresses this realization in a beautiful way. He says, "The day my mother died, I wrote in my journal, 'A serious misfortune of my life has arrived. I suffered for more than 1 year after the passing away of my mother. But one night in the highlands of Vietnam, I was sleeping in the hut in my hermitage. I dreamed of my mother. I saw myself sitting with her, and we were having a wonderful talk. She looked young and beautiful, her hair flowing down. It was so pleasant to sit there and talk to her as if she had never died. When I woke up, it was about 2 a.m, and I felt very strongly that I had never lost my mother. The impression that my mother was still with me was very clear. I understood then that the idea of having lost my mother was just an idea. It was obvious in that moment that my mother is always alive in me. I opened the door and went outside. The entire hillside was bathed in moonlight. It was a hill covered with tea plants, and my hut was set behind the temple halfway up. Walking slowly in the moonlight through the rows of tea plants, I noticed my mother was still with me. She was the moonlight caressing me as she had done so often, very tender, very sweet, wonderful. Each time my feet touched the earth, I knew my mother was there with me. I knew this body was not mine alone, but a living continuation of my mother and my father and my grandparents and great-grandparents, of all my ancestors. These feet that I saw as my feet were actually our feet. Together, my mother and I were leaving footprints in the damp soil. From that moment on, the idea that I had lost my mother no longer existed. All I had to do was look at the palm of my hand, feel the breeze on my face or the earth under my feet, to remember that my mother is always with me, available at any time. So this first expression of the awakened heart mind is that experience of oneness, of undividedness, that lets us know that every being and every part of this world belongs in our heart, like the waves on the surface of the ocean. The second part is, wisdom tells me I'm no thing. The poet Rumi says, I must have been incredibly simple or drunk or insane to sneak into my own house and steal money, to climb over the fence and take my own vegetables, but no more. I've gotten free of that ignorant fist that was pinching and twisting my secret self. The universe and the light of the stars come through me. I am the crescent moon put up over the gate to the festival. Now, I read that because what holds together the sense of I am something, not nothing, is a sense that something's wrong and I'm trying to do something about it. And if you considered for yourself, what would your experience of who you are be in this moment if you truly experienced it as nothing is wrong with me? Who would you be? I could say it another way. If you no longer believe that something is wrong with me, what would your experience of your being be? Srinir Sargadatta says, I love this description of realization. He says, upon realization, you can't exactly describe what happened. All you can say is, nothing is wrong with me anymore. And I think that's as good as any other description. It's the linchpin. Whether we have it framed as something is wrong with me, or you, or life. And the moment that there's that sense of what I am, has nothing to do with any story of something's wrong. There's freedom. So we'll do another reflection on wisdom says I'm no thing. But before it, I'd like to share a bit of how Eckhart Tolle describes this. He says basically that the experience of awareness, and this is in all the traditions, is not, if you say, well, pay attention to awareness itself, there's nothing you can see or feel or taste or touch. So it's a difficult thing to be told to do. It's because it's called no-thingness, it's empty. And yet something in us, and this is the way Eckhart Tolle puts it, he says something in us has an affinity with space and openness, and I'll add silence and stillness. Something in us has an affinity because it points to what we are. He says, when you're aware of space and openness, it's really awareness becoming aware of itself. When there's an apprehension of no form, when the ear finds nothing to hear, it's perceived as stillness, silence, emptiness. We have experiences that resonate because they point to awareness. When we contemplate the unfathomable depth of space or listen to silence in the early hours before the sunrise, or listen to the silence that's here, there's a kind of recognition. He says, you then sense the vast depth of space as your own depth, and you know that precious stillness that has no form to be more deeply who you are than any of the things that make up the content of your life. So again, they're words that point to a sense of beingness that we intuit and we sense in our experience. So let me ask you to again, let there be a pause and let the attention deepen. And as we do again and again, begin right here with the experience that's right here. Let your senses be wide open. It says the Tibetans say, utterly awake, sense doors wide open. Utterly open, non-fixating awareness. Utterly awake, senses wide open. Utterly open, non-fixating awareness. Including the symphony of sound. This whole field of sensation. Whatever emotions or moods are moving through the heart. And in addition to being conscious of what's in the foreground, the sense perceptions, emotions, sensations, there's an undercurrent of awareness. You can be conscious of being conscious. If you can sense an alert inner stillness in the background, while things happen in the foreground, that's it. You can even inquire, can I feel my own presence? And without any thoughts, just be that awake, open space. Aware of sounds and aware of the silence that's listening. Of this vibrating aliveness that's here. and the vast stillness that's aware. This awake, luminous awareness is home. It's what we are. To realize you are the supreme source of everything is simply to recognize this awareness and be it. As the Tibetans say, it's closer than we can imagine, this loving, alive presence. It's not out there or down the road. It's right here. And it's more profound beyond any concept. It's easier than we imagine. Like a backward step or relaxing back into what is. And it's more wondrous. To realize our beingness is to then love and celebrate all the waves and expressions of existence. Again, the words of Rumi to close. I've gotten free of that ignorant fist that was pinching and twisting my secret self. The universe and the light of the stars come through me. I am the crescent moon put up over the gate to the festival. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.